let's jump into our first session, where we're going to be joined by four of the world's top chief learning officers to discuss how we can develop the leaders who can deliver in this disrupted 21st century. To do this, I'm joined by Simon Brown at Novartis, Stefan van Hooijdonk at Cognizant, James Fulton from Goldman Sachs, and Vidya Krishnan from Ericsson. Hi, everyone. How are you all?
Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Before we jump in, sort of just very briefly for everyone, just kind of tell everyone a little bit about yourself and sort of your sort of journey to where we are today. We'll start with yourself, Simon.
Yep. So Simon Brown, I'm Chief Learning Officer at Novartis. We're a focused medicine company, 108,000 people all around the world.
Just 108. Just
108.
Stefan?
Stefan van Hooijdonk, Chief Learning Officer for Cognizant. Have been in the learning space for 25 plus years, spanning different industries, different continents, different companies, and now Chief Learning Officer of Cognizant, 300,000 people. But it doesn't really matter whether you have 100,000, 200,000. It's just many, many beautiful souls that you need to improve or you need to help to get to the next stage.
Yeah.
Vidya Krishnan, the Chief Learning Officer for Ericsson. We are an ICT company, information and communications technology, about 100,000 people in 180 countries, unleashing the power of 5G.
Hi, I'm James. I'm the Chief Learning Officer at Goldman Sachs. It's a financial services company. Chris, you asked us how we got into this field. I come from a family of teachers and doctors. And so what we do, I think, collectively on this panel, for me, is a vocation, much more than a job. It's something I feel very passionate about, strong sense of purpose. I'm really looking forward to the next few minutes in the conversation.
Amazing. Well, look, Simon, I said to you beforehand, I'm going to pick on you first. So I'm going to make sure I live up to that. Let's jump straight in to the deep end. How can we help people have the resilience that they need for a fast-changing world that we're in right now?
Yep. So I guess for me, there's two parts to this, and thank you for giving me 10, 15 minutes to at least think about it. I think one is around making sure we're helping people to build those resilient skills. So that's access to great content around that. And if I look within Novartis, particularly over the last 3 months with everything that's going on in the world, resilience has been absolutely critical. So we've had things like curated playlists, portals pointing people towards content to help them build their resilience, whether that's virtual training, whether that's self-study materials, etc., as well as things like apps around mindfulness and other elements as well. So that sort of whole self piece, and we've seen people embracing that and taking advantage of it. So I think that would be one side of things. I think the other side is more broadly around learning, and we looked at this in the book Curious Advantage that I've been doing over the last year, where actually by learning and being curious, that actually builds confidence, and that confidence then makes us more resilient. So as things are changing, that ambiguity is actually being curious and learning that helps us through that ambiguity by finding out what works, what doesn't, and that gives us then the resilience to go forward.
Amazing. And feel free to jump in, guys, at any point.
I think this entire area of resilience, I call these meta skills. Because until most of us in learning and development have been focusing on skills and knowledge forever. But now, only after the last couple of years, I'm noticing that the entire area of mindset is coming in. And a lot of us in L&D have been afraid of the area of mindset, because how on earth can we change people's mindset? But actually, as we all know, at least in our industry and in our profession, that you can actually change people's mindset. You can change people's perspectives. And I call these meta skills, and curiosity is a beautiful meta skills, and Simon is clearly kind of propelling this. But you also have growth mindset. You have learned to learn learning strategies, because somehow the tricks of the past are not helping us anymore towards the future. And what we're doing in terms of knowledge and skills is basically replicating some past knowledge and hoping that it's going to help us towards the future, while resilience is all about creativity, growth mindset, curiosity, that even without having that knowledge, it still helps us to solve big, important issues for our company. So I think it's a beautiful topic to start this conference off with.
And Chris, I feel that resilience, as Simon and Stefan alluded to, is also, I mean, it's the unknown of the future, and you have to meet that future with a combination of definitely curiosity, also courage, and also compassion. And I think to Stefan's point, this is a whole new paradigm for learning to feel that we are responsible to create the conditions in which people can change their skill sets and change their mindsets. And that courage comes not just from the individual competence building, but from what you do as a team. And I think sometimes the compassion comes from our being able to create this feeling of safety in the face of the unknown. You don't know what's ahead, but we're trying to flip the script so that building skills is not just something that you do to get your next opportunity, but something that you do while chasing that next opportunity. So that the unknown, given that it's unknown, may be unfamiliar, but it's no longer so unfriendly. I think that the conditions also are something we have to influence.
It's such an interesting question. Chris, I actually want to just challenge some of the assumptions. I heard you ask the question, how do we help our people build be resilient? I think what we've seen over the past few months is actually how much resilience already people have. And so I actually wonder, number one, and so although no doubt all our companies and many of the people joining this conversation run resilience programs, there's actually, I think our starting point should be the people we work with are already resilient. We shouldn't see them deficient and having to, you know, open their heads or their bodies and put resilience into them. So it's actually, how do we cultivate and bring that resilience out? In fact, the question I think is just as important is how do we develop compassion as resilience? My worry about the resilience conversation, and I know it's very common, but my worry is that, and this is kind of, I think what you were saying, Video, what I heard you say, is the implication is more and more is going to come at you. And so to withstand the increasing pace of change and complexity and demands, you need to be more resilient. But I actually think, certainly now, if in nowhere else in an organization, it needs to occur in the learning function, taking a step back and say, well, what's going on in the system that we're needing to give our people thicker armor to withstand more demands, meaning more resilience? Like, what's going on at that picture? And maybe a way into that conversation, those insights, is actually how do we develop compassion? And so it's a critically important conversation, but I think there are symptoms. It's a symptom of something as well as an issue in its own right.
I also think
the resilience comes from that place.
Right.
Sorry, the resilience comes from that place of vulnerability and compassion.
I think it's also about organizational compassion. Because I think there's organizations are putting up in many, many companies a lot of hurdles for people to really be resilient. It's in many organizations, learning is not productive time. Or in many organizations, learning is okay for the here and now, but maybe not for the tomorrow. And or in many companies, rotation is just lip service. Because we don't really do that. That's what I mean with organizational compassion, getting under the skin of everybody and creating the culture and climate to do the right things is important.
Which is then really interesting if you look at skills going redundant faster and faster and our skills expiring, that actually by getting people, like you said, Stephanie, learning how to learn and that growth mindset, that curiosity to be able to keep learning actually gives you a fantastic tool for resilience, because as you see things changing, you build that confidence to be able to cope with it. And that's long term, because you whatever those changes in skills come, you know, you've demonstrated you can learn things quickly and learn new skills, and you can then cope with whatever is thrown at you.
I think Vidya, in our last conversation, you put it really cool where you said you're building an empathy engine, right? And in your organization, could you share more about that? Because I thought that was something that really stood out to me, that a lot of our listeners in our last show resonated with.
I think for me, an empathy engine means that our ecosystem, especially our learning ecosystem, thrives on biodiversity, like any ecosystem. And all of the technology and the compassion has to be engineered, because something that cultivates empathy means that our learners are learning not just from the content, but from one another and with one another. And the highest purpose our ecosystem can serve is to connect our people to one another and let them experience learning together and from one another. But we have to do that, as was alluded to earlier, we have to do that at scale. And that requires empathy to not just be this hoped for or accidental good consequence, but something we deliberately try to engineer systematically at scale, with speed. And so for me, I think this notion of an empathy engine kind of guides our ecosystem forward about how to make it seamless, how to make learning easy, how to make it matter, how to make that connectivity allow for compassion to take hold and for people to share their reality so that, again, resilience is not just, resilience is a team sport. It's not just something we're trying to cultivate in the individual, but something that we're truly trying to cultivate in the community where people have each other's back because they understand one another's learning lives. I think that's what it means for us. And I think our technology can get us there if we are human about how we apply it.
Mm-hmm. Could you share some of the ways you're doing that, Vidya? Because from a practical sense for everyone listening?
Yeah, certainly. I think for one thing, definitely when we look at our ecosystem, we see a need to simplify and automate, use the power of AI. We've talked about how we use platforms like Degreed, go a long way in helping us connect learners to content, but also to community and to one another. I think that's crucial. I think an empathy engine is one where you look at one another, not just based on the role that you play or the title that you have, but on the mix of skills, experiences, interests, passion, curiosity. When we can show that our engines and ecosystems also allow us to look at each other and look at ourselves in that way by showing and visualizing the skills that are necessary or that the skills that people possess, the skills that people could learn, I think it also creates a kind of openness and mobility that we wouldn't have had before to the same extent. And then the other thing I think when we talk about an empathy engine is really a teaching culture. We firmly believe that in an era where reskilling becomes almost a form of recruiting, the ability of people within the company to teach one another on a scale that they have not done before, and for us to be able to know who they are, show who they are, and then grow how they teach others and have that count for something. That to me is, these are some of the ways that we are very, very invested in building out our empathy engine.
I'm fully with you. But yeah, I use different words, but I think we're trying to say the same. I'm saying that learning is not only about consumptions, but it's also about contribution.
Yes.
And I'm often saying that I'm the proud owner of 300,000 trainers. Because everybody has something good to share with at least one other person, and very likely many more people. So it's for L&D, it's not anymore to create classes, but how do we bring these people meaningfully together? And that's a challenge, but that's fine. That's a positive challenge to have. That's very much resonate.
I think what I hear both of you say, and it is what I think, so maybe it's confirmation bias, I think learning is shifting from being about skills to actually being about culture and being about kind of doing to about performing. And what I mean by that is, and I've certainly seen this just as a practitioner, I've been, you know, in the field for several years, 20 years, is actually, as, and you said it, Vidya, the convening power of the learning function is in some ways, I'm increasingly think the most important asset. It's not really about what you know as a result of it. It's who do you meet, what conversations occur, what relationships are built, and what possibilities are opened.
Yes.
And the challenge is that sounds very fluffy to the hard-nosed, you know, the finance department, but actually that's the stuff of culture. That's how culture is built and how culture is shifted. Yeah. And on the point of empathy, and actually that's where empathy, it kind of is created and exists. And I think that's been shown no more visibly and powerfully than in the last few weeks. In the discussions that we've had, and no doubt many of you have had about race, where those, you know, really to make a step forward, to make a shift there is not about how do I learn, you know, what skills do I learn? It's actually about empathy. Empathy is the core engine, and conversations are really the catalyst to move us forward in that particularly challenging and difficult issue. And so, you know, much like COVID has shone a light on resilience, I think race has shone a light on empathy in these past few weeks and months. And if you know, and if through the distress of the events, those I think have been the silver lining, that both empathy and resilience have had a chance to kind of come to the fore and be valued.
I think we see it sort of becomes the role for all of us to help to create that space, that environment. But I think it's also not an either or with skills as well. So we're also seeing how do you create the culture, the space, the motivation for people to be able to invest time in themselves in that learning. But also then how do we use skills as the currency almost within that, and then to take that outside of learning into other HR processes as well. So how do you look at things like pay for skills, or how do you look at skills going into talent acquisition and the build, buy, borrow piece.
This episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. Two-thirds of employees have one foot out the door in 2024, and the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
So it's almost sort of skills becomes a currency or a language within what we're doing, going into broader HR processes. And then there's the bigger picture piece, which is how do we create the environment, the culture where that empathy, that learning can actually take place.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I've struggled with in terms of creating that environment that you're describing is being able to do that via these, you know, Zoom calls, Microsoft Teams, digitally. I've really struggled with that over the last few months, and I know many others have. Is, you know, those hallways conversations that I've, you know, bump into an employee and have that spark and that dialogue, or, you know, do I drop into that meeting and find out that this is something, an area where I can add value, and that those exchanges that happen organically in the workplace. I'm really struggling to. I'm almost now saying to my team, can I just drop in on your meetings now and again, just so I can kind of jump in and just see how things, not because I want to see, are you doing any work, but really thinking, where can I add value? I'm trying to recreate that feeling. I'm just wondering if you guys are experiencing anything similar on your end.
Endlessly. We've never craved human connection more. And for me, all the digital platforms, their highest purpose is to sort of disappear and make it feel like it's just human natural connection. I think to your point, Chris, operating rhythm, something people don't think about very often, becomes more crucial than ever. The predictability of knowing I'm going to hang out with my team on Fridays, we're going to do this fun thing, we're going to meet on these things. But then also what we share at certain meetings about creating the visibility that Simon alluded to seeing the skills. What skills matter? What skills matter more than ever? What skills maybe are fading to the back burner? And being able to connect with people in ways where we're deliberately learning together, I think has become more crucial and more precious than ever before. And you're right, it doesn't happen naturally anymore. It's got that back to the engine notion. You've got to engineer that time and that connection.
Yeah. I think especially when it comes to the empathy piece, doing it over a video call, it just, to me, it just doesn't feel the same.
No. I want to take a different view, Chris. I'll give you the counterpoint to that. Because one of the functions, I myself, I'm an executive coach, and we have executive coaching, and we have a strong bench internally of executive coaches. And what we found as internal executive coaches, we were at first very worried by coaching over Zoom. But actually, what we've noticed is conversations are more intimate and more reflective. So, for example, the fact that you can see into someone's home, that they're talking to you from their home, and then actually you have the screen is a little bit of a protective barrier in a way, we found. And so coaching for us, surprisingly, over the last few months has actually been much more impactful, which has been a surprise. The other benefit, and I agree with all the downsides, but the other benefit that we're thinking hard about how do we retain as and when we move back is the egalitarian nature of Zoom or Teams or Skype. You know, we work in a global function like all of you, like many people who are joining this call. And for a lot, you know, the long time, there are these, you know, discrepancies between are you at the head office or not? And suddenly we're all in the same place. And that's been a very welcome egalitarian move. And so those have been two benefits we're going to look to maintain or build on as we move forward.
I think there's another one that personally have seen as well, which is we use Teams as our main meeting technology, and with the chat piece going down the side, one of the things, one of my own personal development points is around sometimes holding back in meetings and not chipping in because, you know, someone else is talking. My natural English politeness is I don't want to interrupt them, and before you know it, the conversation has moved on and I miss making a point. But actually with the chat, you can then be getting that out into the chat. So for the diversity across the meeting, the rich of actually having multiple channels going at the same time, and then other people jumping in and liking and things. I think there's there's absolutely all the downsides of the human contact bit, but I think there's also some interesting upsides, particularly as we start to use some of the tools more holistically, that actually brings more diverse conversations potentially into some of the meetings. So.
As well, but I want to kind of move the conversation on to sort of data, because a lot of people focusing on how are you guys using data. So I'll start with yourself, Stefan. How are you sort of embracing data in your role, and sort of what's the correlation between attrition and learning?
Okay, I'm really big on data. I'm probably too big on two things. I'm big on point of view and data, because I want all my people to have a really strong point of view. The challenge with learning is that everybody has an opinion, because everybody went to school, and therefore everybody thinks, and also, and often we're talking to more senior people than ourselves, at least our teams are, and we also, that they're always directing us in a certain direction. And data is really powerful to keep the conversation going. I think when I just joined at Cognizant, I once had this balcony moment. I went into a meeting unprepared, and with a head of a business. And immediately this conversation went into an order-taking mode. While when you have a data in front of you, suddenly you're discussing the data as two adults. And that made me, that strengthened my view on data. And I'm lucky to have a data team. And data is all about being Sherlock Holmes all the time, I think. No, thinking about hypotheses and then figuring out whether those hypotheses make sense. And we did hypotheses about indeed attrition and learning. I could talk about it in a second. We also did a hypothesis about success of a manager in terms of his or her learning mentality versus success of a team. So does the shadow of the manager reflect back into a team? If a manager learns well, does a team learn well? Or if the manager doesn't learn well, does a team learn badly? And that actually we've proven that, and it's really good for the good managers, not so good for the not so good managers. So what are you doing about the managers that are not really kind of taking that? But it's, I think all of us are sitting on so much data. How do we turn that data into information? And everybody is coming from different perspectives. I think we've been struggling in learning and development for the last zillions of years on how to prove ROI, and I think data is now enabling us. And for instance, also with attrition and learning, we had an hypothesis a while ago and said, actually, if learning is so powerful as we in L&D are claiming, then maybe there should be an impact on attrition. And actually, we've proven that the people, if there's more learning happening, either the company asking the individuals to learn, or the individuals learning on their own accord through a pull mechanism, then we're seeing higher learning gets reflected into higher staying back in the company. And you also see that in a lot of kind of these industry reports, employees are asking kindly of the companies, give me more and more learning, because if you give me more learning, I will stay back. And we've proven that in the organization. So I think data is so important. And not only the data that we're sitting on as L&D folks, but also the relationships within these attrition numbers, with sales, with productivity, with all of the other groups that are sitting in the same garden, that we could just have to kind of work with those other colleagues and saying, okay, can we match our data with your data? And I've noticed that data talks. Mm-hmm. That data opens people's minds. My CEO is saying, if that's the case, you guys are paying for yourselves, your budget, so I'm going to double your budget immediately, type of thing. You know, that's the power of using those data and speaking also the language of your customers, type of thing. I don't know. I hope it makes sense. I see some nuts.
Yeah. We see something very, very similar, Stefan. It sounds like you're slightly further ahead on the journey. So, but the last year we've built an analytics team and been looking at it, and same hypothesis of learning hours through to attrition. We have an aspiration for our associates to be able to spend 5% of their time or 100 learning hours a year. And we're looking at that hypothesis of, is it the more time they spend learning, what's the impact on attrition? And we're at a sort of 60-70% confidence level at the moment. So it sounds like you're probably a bit further ahead in actually making that link, and we're trying to get it up to a sort of 70-80% confidence. But what we're seeing is the more time that people are spending learning, the less chance that they will leave the organization. And so that's very reassuring to hear that you've already proven that. And if we can get that a little bit further, then hopefully we'll have data that also backs up that same argument as well. But it's hugely powerful when you can then look at concrete data and see these things coming through. I fully agree with you.
And I think the language of analytics provides a new language for us to connect skill building with business sensing in a way that we really haven't been able to do proactively or predictively. It's been always a bit reactive. We see something and we say, oh, we know we need to start building this skill. We know we need to reskill or upskill. But now the predictive power of analytics to actually tell us in advance that based on the deals that are being pursued or the deals that are being won or what people are chatting about in Skype and Teams and the things that teams are trying to do, that there is a surge in some skill that maybe we wouldn't have seen coming for years, but now we can get in front of it so much faster. I think that is something I'm extremely excited about, that analytics could start to become both an impetus for skill building, but also an indicator that, look, we are actually creating the conditions where people can reinvent themselves. We had people in this role before. Now they are delivering in this other role. That's so much more important than how many hours they spent and their consumption. The fact that we were able to shift people and shift our workforce analytics and see the effect of our skill building reflected in our workforce analytics, but then also predicted in our business analytics, I think opens new doors for us. And then it reinforces what you said, that people start to believe this is a company where I can reinvent myself over and over again in the direction of my calling, in the direction of creating value for the company. And what can be more sticky than that, you know, in terms of employee engagement and people wanting to stay. So I think that's a virtuous cycle we should tap into.
I want to jump into curiosity, because Simon definitely going to want to jump in here. You know, innovation is often linked to curiosity. You know, how do you foster a culture of curiosity at Novartis? Could you share how you're doing that in Novartis, Simon, to kick us off, that, you know, promotes, recognizes, and rewards curiosity?
Yeah, absolutely. And research recently that there is a link between curiosity and innovation. So INSEAD did some research, and so, you know, if you are more curious, you know, that has a positive impact through on innovation. So there's a strong linkage that is there. So it's part of our overall culture. So we have a culture around being inspired, curious, and unbossed. And we've been on a journey for the last 2 years to transform the culture towards that. The curiosity part is about learning, but it is also about being curious more broadly around asking questions, around exploring, around experimentation. From the learning part, there are many, I guess, pillars to how we're trying to foster curiosity. So some of that is around access to things to be curious about. So content, information, great learning resources, etc. We added things like Coursera, LinkedIn across the company last year, and that's been taken up hugely positively. So having access to content is one. Having easy access to be able to find things is another. So consolidating things into a single portal, having playlists from influencers and experts across the company recommending learning, recommending articles, recommending things to read, to listen to, etc. is another part. But then what we hear is that the barriers that people have to being curious and to being able to learn and grow is around time to learn and is around manager not supporting me. So those are the two biggest things that we were seeing in our internal pulse surveys that were coming through. And to respond to that, we set the ambition around this 100 hours or 5% of time spent learning. And that wasn't based upon anything scientific about 100 hours being, you know, the absolute amount of time you should spend learning. It was a symbol and a signal to say that the company values learning, and we want people to invest their time learning and take advantage of these great resources to be able to learn. And through that, we've been able to see that learning hours increase, and we've been able to see a positive increase in terms of the engagement scores that relate to people having the opportunities to learn. And then the other piece is around role modeling, leader role modeling, and leader messaging as well. So really trying to have our leaders living that mentality. It comes back to what Stefan was saying about that shadow that a leader casts, that if a leader isn't themselves learning and isn't supporting people in investing time learning and valuing learning, then people won't spend the time to do it and won't value it themselves. And we're very fortunate with our CEO, who is an absolute avid learner and champions that learning in all that he does. And that goes across then our whole leadership teams as well. So it's multiple pillars, I guess, of sort of content, of access, of time, of permission, and the overall sort of culture piece. But all of those things coming together seem to be making a positive impact in that we're now gone from behind benchmark to above benchmark on our engagement scores around learning. We had sort of over 50% increase in learning hours last year, etc.
That sounds so great, Simon. If you went back to the beginning when you started this, like, what do you wish you had known then that you know now?
Yeah, great question. Probably getting leaders engaged earlier, or broadly leaders engaged earlier. I think if I had the data now and I could have used that data 18 months ago, then that would be hugely valuable. So then there was a lot of things saying, you know, we should be doing this intuitively. This feels like the right direction. Whereas now we've got a lot of concrete data to show things. So I think probably building more of a data case earlier on would have been something that would have been a big positive, I think. Yeah.
And maybe building on this, we did some survey with customers in Europe, and we found that about 65% of the 1,000 plus people that we've interviewed were happy with status quo. You often have CEOs having these lofty goals for the next 5 years. We want to go in that direction. And many people, 65% of the people that we've interviewed said, okay, dear CEO, that's your problem. I'm here to work from 9 to 5. I'm here to pay the bill. I'm to pay the bill. So I'm not really with you in that growth trajectory. I'm not really growth minded. I'm not really curious. We also did that survey inside of the organizations. We found higher numbers. So we're very, very happy with that. But still, you have quite a number of people who are not naturally curious because of themselves, because of limiting beliefs, because of the manager not supporting. And I think there's the fact that you're putting curiosity in the middle of your value systems, and I think it's beautiful, Simon, that you're doing that in your organization. It's just boom, up there in your value statement, suddenly attracts attention. It's okay to be curious. And with everything that might entail, and everybody might have a different definition, we're trying to focus on what I call curiosity reengineering, trying to open up people's minds towards indeed the mindset, like what resilience. How do we give people language? What is the difference between an active learner and a passive learner? Am I an active learner or a passive learner? Do I have a fixed or a growth mindset? And suddenly, by having those words, people suddenly have a choice to reflect. Do I want to continue that way, or do I want to change somehow? When we see that the majority of people, like the over 50% of the people, they say that they want to change, or they say 3 months later, maybe I'm now more interested in having an open mind to the world. And I think it's a beautiful start to do that. And, I'm really grateful, Simon, that you're pushing that so much together with your CEO in driving that forward.
Building on what you both said, I think when we think of the disrupted 21st century, for me, the disruption is that the problem solving becomes as important as the problem finding now. And curiosity is the birthplace of that. So not only is it okay to be curious, I think it's increasingly not okay not to be curious. And it's no longer for us, I think, an aspiration. It's an operational bare minimum that we're looking for, you know, in our leadership at every single level, that's the birthplace of empathy. That's in many ways the thing that connects you to your own vulnerability. It's what prompts learning, and it's what helps you go and hunt for the problems that are the ones that we need to be solving, which we often don't know otherwise. So I think it's becoming truly, you know, something that is the bare minimum that we absolutely need in leadership. Because it's what leads and unlocks everything else.
Yeah, the world has become so complex, there is no single clear answer, and therefore it's the curiosity to look broadly and find what works, what doesn't work, and then expand and drill into that. And yeah, if you're not curious to look at all of those options, you won't find the right answer because, yeah, it is so complex.
And I can say within Ericsson, given just the range of technology and all the use cases that technology enables, this cross-domain knowledge becomes increasingly vital. And we are looking not just for that depth anymore, but for that combination of range and breadth. And having come from environments that maybe look nothing like the one that you're in now, but something that you did there, something that maybe even a hobby of yours suddenly makes its presence youthful in the pursuit of the work you're doing now. We can't even see that pinball effect anymore. So we know that it matters. And there's nothing as powerful as curiosity to prompt that valuation of cross-domain knowledge.
I was recently talking with our CEO on this, and he talked about reading David Epstein's book Range, exactly with that view of going go broad. And he cited his own examples of how many of the things that he has been used to make him successful have come from his exploration into fields completely outside of the field he is in, and then learning something there and bringing that back and being able to apply it. And it's that curiosity to look broad that helps in the narrow of where you're actually trying to solve for.
I think it's a critical question because curiosity, no one would argue that curiosity is not a valuable. Mm-hmm. I think it's critical, this question is like, what are you curious about? I recognize the irony in that. but I think many people are curious, you know, intellectually. And what we have done in recent years is actually start many of our programs by locating curiosity in presence. Our hypothesis being, from a place of presence, curiosity flows and is unbounded. So we start with presencing because our hypothesis is that allows you curiosity about, you know, from head, heart, and gut. And in a developmental context, which I guess is our field, we're just as interested in curiosity about me and how I show up, how I'm affecting my team and those around me, how I'm affecting my business, how our business is operating, as in we're just as curious about the how as about the what. And our experience is that presencing is foundational to that. And without that, curiosity becomes at worst a kind of like a theater, like an opportunity to demonstrate how clever you are by asking the most interesting question. And so we I'm curious, Simon, whether that's come up in your research and indeed the other new curiosity, but for us, presencing is really foundational to this notion of curiosity.
Yeah, so we actually looked at this in the Curious Advantage book. So we came up with a model in there called the 7 C's of curiosity. And it looks around, you know, first understanding your context, then you understand your community to learn more broadly, but then you need to curate it back in exactly that, because you've gone too broad, you need to then go narrow, then be able to bring your own creativity, which is, I wonder if we do this or what about we do that. Mm-hmm. But that wondering is not enough, because you need to put it into practice, which we then call construction. And then you experiment, you find out what works, what doesn't work, and it's that application of it that you learn for. Then you apply criticality, which is why, where am I being biased about this? What are the what really worked, what didn't work, what just confirm my bias around the answer? And all of that drives confidence, which comes back to our earlier conversation around, you know, learning and curiosity driving confidence, which goes back to the start. Then if you're confident, you can then be more curious, and the whole thing sort of goes into a virtuous cycle. So tries to put some structure around that of, you know, how do you channel that curiosity, go broad, go narrow, you know, push the boundaries, but then be critical of where you're going and really experiment with it.
Yeah.
And I feel, James, connecting that to something Stefan said earlier about the power of data, you know, you're so right that it's not just intellectual curiosity, it's experiential curiosity. So we want all of the skill building and the ecosystem and the empathy engine to actually connect people to opportunities, to assignments, to volunteer things, to try things, to taste jobs, to, you know, shadow someone for a day or an hour even. Something so different from what they know that it's not just that intellectual curiosity, but it actually becomes that the skill building leads to kind of a plethora of opportunity tasting that helps people discover what is my calling, what do I like, what do I not like, and feeling that within this company, not only can I reinvent myself, I can actually have the diversity of experiences that are going to bring out my best talents and expose me to new ones and make me learn about myself in a deeper way than I could just intellectually. It's got to be experiential.
Yeah, there are many ways, there are many forms of knowing.
Yeah.
Just, there are many forms of learning.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, when I, if I were to take a drug from Novartis,
yep,
I would want to be certain that it works. I don't want that scientist to have curiosity. I want him or her to know. So how do you deal with that tension or that shift in your culture? When do you shift? When is it allowed, and how do you manage that? How do you find the boundary?
Yeah, I actually had a session yesterday with our some of our quality team, and a similar question came up, which is we have standard operating procedures, and you know, should we be being curious around those standard operating procedures? And it's like, no, there are procedures that we have, and those are there because that means we can get to a medicine that is safe and produced in the same way. However, applying curiosity to say, actually, maybe there's a better way. I'll find the person who owns this operating procedure and suggest a better way, and then we can test that out through other channels. Absolutely. But the whole, I guess, drug development life cycle is all about curiosity from, you know, which of these molecules is going to have an impact on this disease? You know, how do we be curious about how we get that that molecule to the right part of the body to react in the right way? What's the vehicle to do it? So there's a huge amount of curiosity throughout the whole process. But you're absolutely right. There are things in there where it needs to just 100% follow a process in there accurately, and there's no room for deviation from it. So that is a bit of a balance to be found, where encouraging curiosity in the right way, but also recognizing there's 100% adherence to operating procedures and things in another way.
I don't think curiosity is a free for all to be curious in all directions. I also often link curiosity to organizational curiosity. And you're talking about, how do we learn from the deals we win? How do we learn from the deals we lose? Do we do after-action reviews and things like that, that the army is so good at, but few of us in organizations are good at? So I think it's just being interested in all the biases that we might have. Are we looking for confirmation bias within our team because this drug is good, or because this financial service is good, or because 5G is good, or do we allow these remote voices to ask these stupid questions? No, are in our teams, and are we curious to listen to those folks? I think it's more at a level of culture than a level of individuals, just free-for-all type of things.
And I think, going back to the point you made, Simon, about the environment that you find yourself in that range book, Epstein makes a really cool distinction between, there are some problem-solving environments that he calls kind, meaning they're somewhat predictable. The operating procedure will always, you know, save the day, and it's to be followed to the letter. But there are many environments that he calls wicked, in the sense that what you know in these environments is actually more of a limitation than a protection. And we, as employees, I think, also have to get good at spotting, is this a kind environment of problem solving that I have to do right now, where rigor, expertise, you know, the depth is much more critical, or am I actually in sort of a wicked environment where what I know can actually hurt me because it puts blinders on, and I have to be curious and go pull in solutions from other areas. And I think that is also increasingly characterizing our 21st century. There are these environments that are kind, and there are these environments like solving COVID-19 that are absolutely wicked. They are challenging everything that used to work before. And that requires a different arsenal. And I think that distinction becomes tricky.
Can we teach ourselves to be curious?
Yeah, so we looked at this as well. Yeah. So yes, we believe you can. That I think there is an inherent curiosity that we have, and you know, as children, typically you start being very curious, and then as parents, all of us are, don't touch that, you know, stop asking about that, don't do that, and we sort of inadvertently take some of that curiosity away from people. And in organizations in the past, we've also taken away that curiosity of, you know, that's just how we do it around here, you know, don't ask why, you know, just do it the way you're told type piece. Whereas, you know, now, for all the reasons that we've been talking about, that's not the way that the things need to be. But yes, we believe that through through that sort of going through the process of being curious, that builds confidence that then further perpetuates it. And there's a neuroscience angle for how that works in your brain. But there's a process of actually training yourself to become more curious as well. So yes, even if you don't feel curious, that doesn't mean you can't become curious. Yeah.
I really appreciate you all taking the time to join us for the summit, an incredible way to kick off the summit. So I really appreciate it. If there's sort of a one parting piece of advice for everyone listening, what would that be for each of you? And if anyone wants to connect with you and say hello, what's the best place they can do that?
I believe we're entering a moment in history, a period in history where there has to be zero tolerance for zero learning, zero tolerance for zero curiosity, zero tolerance for zero empathy. It cannot be. And I think we have to arm ourselves with that paradigm shift, that the new era of our life demands nothing less than for us to be deeply empathetic, unapologetically, relentlessly curious, and to make learning not just a priority, but a habit. And I would be happy to talk to anyone. You can reach me through LinkedIn or vidya.krishnan@ericsson.com. Thank you for having us.
So yeah, just be curious that, you know, as an individual, you know, for an organization, and even more broadly for society, it has to be a good thing. And if you want more details on some of the things we're doing, then check out the Curious Advantage
book. Or grab the book. Where's the book?
Yeah. You going to Amazon. So curiousadvantage.com or on Amazon, then you'll find it under the Curious Advantage.
Yeah.
I think everything we spoke about is all about how do we reinvent ourselves as learning and development function. And are we teaching you tricks of the past? Are we happy with that? Or are we reinventing ourselves? And I think we have a beautiful road ahead of us. If we all only apply all these things that we spoke about, curiosity, resilience, new way of thinking, throughout our own environments. And I think it's a beautiful future for all of us. You can contact me on LinkedIn, I guess that's the easiest thing. Happy to talk to you.
It's like a promo for LinkedIn at the moment. And last but not least, James.
I think the primary question for learners, I was taught this by Jim Dethmer, is can you be here now? Mm. And if you can be present, then from that flows all the topics and the qualities and the attributes about which we've spoken. And I know that mindfulness, many people practice mindfulness, and I know that self-awareness is a huge part of that. I think the other and less spoken about part of that is self-compassion. And so the question of can you be here now and be self-compassionate, for me, is foundational to learning.